Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. Tēnei ka mihi ke te mana whenua o Aotearoa. And we acknowledge the local tribal authorities of New Zealand.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt and I'm currently coming to you from Darumbal country in Queensland. Before we dive into our conversation today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. Finally, if you enjoy this potty, please subscribe, comment, like or share on our social media and consider buying us a coffee if you'd like to help support our work. Now on with the show.
Welcome to part two of our chat with Dr. Audi. Now, I say part two because we first had a fascinating chat with him 3 years ago, back in season two, episode 33. And whilst I'm sure we will recap some of the background in this episode, once you're done listening, I am certain you'll be wanting more. So make sure you search his name on our channel in the search bar and give that a listen to.
Yep, as Ben said, today we're very lucky to have a return guest on the show, the wonderful Dr. Jack Audi, who first joined us way back when in season two. So to echo Ben's words for anyone that hasn't taken a listen to that one yet, please do. We had such good feedback on that episode. It was truly fascinating chat and a very moving one too. But if Jack is new to you, he is a lecturer in the medical sciences in the School of Medicine at the University of Tasmania. His research focuses on how inflammation can contribute to disease. And today we'll be focusing in on his work with Adrift Lab, where he's been looking at wildlife affected by microplastic exposure. So we're looking forward to touching base again. Jack, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, kia ora to both of you and to the listeners and Yapalinga. I'd like to acknowledge the Murrawina people whose land I am currently on as well before we get started too. Thank you so much for having me back on. We've had some pretty big stuff happen since the last time, so we've got a lot to talk about, I'm sure. But I'm happy to take any questions and jump into some of the research that I've been up to.
Amazing. So as I've mentioned, our listeners, go back and get the full backstory in the first episode. But for those that are new and don't know who this wonderful Jack Audi is, quick little background. Last time we chatted, you had a one-year-old, presume now four. Time has moved on. Tell us a little bit about, just briefly where you're at. You're in Hobart, University of Tasmania, and still with the Drift Lab as well. So just give us a little overview of where things are at the moment for you.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so I'm a researcher. I researched sort of inflammation my whole life and pathology and how the immune system can actually contribute to disease. This actually started with my PhD at the University of Otago, a wonderful university. I love it. I hope my one-year-old who's now four will go there one day. In that I was researching how inflammation might actually contribute to stroke. And for my PhD, I was actually researching how marijuana, which is a known immune suppressant, might help stroke outcomes. Because if your brain is inflamed and swelling following stroke, and stroke is basically a blood clot or a bleed in your brain, the idea was if we could suppress the immune system, perhaps we would minimize the amount of damage that occurs during the inflammation and swelling of the brain, which is always a big concern, the swelling of a brain. It's got nowhere to go. Unlike rolling an ankle, when your ankle swells up, it can just stretch out. There's nowhere for it to go in the brain. So inflammation in the brain is thought to be a very, very bad thing. And marijuana is known to suppress the immune system, which can be beneficial in inflammatory conditions, perhaps. Unfortunately, what I found was no effect. My whole PhD was 4 years, and I found no effect of these drugs. It turns out very difficult to improve stroke outcomes. And it might be because the immune system is doing some good stuff as well as some bad stuff. So it might be clearing out broken neurons, and it also might be causing swelling and releasing damaging molecules. So it might be about flicking the right switches to get the right immune system to the brain injury that you've got. So that was my PhD. I then went to Manchester, and there I studied Alzheimer's disease, which I know you want to touch on, which is a form of dementia where you get memory deficits, and then that continues to decline. And then I moved to the University of Tasmania, and my research has expanded a little bit. It's still in dementia. It's several kinds of dementia now, but also microplastics. And it sounds like they're unrelated, but they are very... They are related. Whether one causes the other, we don't know yet. Whether microplastics causes dementia or contributes to dementia, we don't know. But some of the molecular things that are occurring during plastic exposure and dementia are quite similar. Now, I met my wife in Otago, who you wanted me to catch up on, and she's just basically followed me around. She's such a sweetheart. I'm always like, hey, I want to go do some research over there. And she's like, well, let's go. I love it. She grew up all over the world, so she loves just traveling and going to new places. So, and so now we had a one-year-old, and now that one-year-old's almost four, and we've got another one-year-old now. And annoyingly enough, because I'm an immunologist, right, I went into all the research about how to avoid allergies, right? And there's lots of research, because allergies have gone from something like 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, something to that level, now to 20 to 30% of people have an allergy. So something crazy has happened in the last 50 years to cause allergies to pop out of nowhere. You know, suddenly everyone has an allergy when it used to be no one had allergies. And so I went into all the research to try and make sure my sons had no allergies. And there's a lot of interesting research out there. There's a study showing that if you can get a dog before your kid is 4 months old, there's, because dogs maybe bring in dirt and expose your kids to all these dirty stuff, maybe that helps reduce allergies. So we got a dog. The other big research is exposure. So having things during pregnancy and during the first 4 months of life seems to limit your allergies to it. So if you're pregnant, if the mother has peanuts, it's less likely to the child's less likely to be allergic. So I was making Ollie all sorts of things to make sure she exposed Charlie to all the common allergies. I even made, because Ollie hates shellfish, I made an oyster smoothie for her so she would get exposed to shellfish. I know, I feel terrible.
Too far, Jack, too far.
The and then measures. You wouldn't,
I know, the measures. But then my first child, Charlie, comes out with 7 allergies, including an anaphylactic allergy to dairy, which is so hard, like chocolate cake. It's one of the hardest allergies to avoid. And I feel like I failed as an immunologist. I missed something there. To me, and you shouldn't let your personal experiences influence how you interpret data, but the principle I was operating on is basically the exposure, also known as the hygiene principle, that if we're too clean and we avoid all the allergens and antigens and everything like that, our body doesn't learn that they're safe. So letting your kids play in the dirt and get food all over their face and get mucky and not just have baby formula in their first year of life, letting your kids getting exposed to all of that, this is the idea, right? One of the competing hypotheses is literally worms. And this sounds strange, but your immune system has different responses to different pathogens. So if it has a virus, it has a different response to a bacteria, which has a different response to a worm. Now, largely speaking, anaphylactic shock, anaphylactic allergies, is your body misidentifying a chemical as a worm. So it's thinking that the peanuts that you've just eaten is a worm. So it's having an anti-worm response. And this is all dependent on which antibodies are released. So if you get the COVID vaccine, you're going to produce an antibody called IgG, which is an antiviral, antibacterial antibody. But if you get infected with a worm, you're going to release an antibody called IgA, and that's an anti-worm antibody. And IgA is also responsible for your allergies. Sorry, IgA and IgE, both of those antibodies together are anti-worms. Anyway, when humans evolved, every single one of us had worms, pretty much. And if you go to developing nations, the worm burden is through the roof. Virtually everybody in developing nations has worms. And so we evolved with worms in our guts. And worms release chemicals that suppress our anti-worm response, so the worm doesn't get kicked out of our body. So they are constantly releasing a chemical that suppresses that part of our immune system, so we don't produce those antibodies and we don't kill the worm and kick it out of our guts. Now, in modern society, we've virtually eliminated worms with our clean water and our engineering and the anti-worm pills. And so my own personal experience shifts me from the hygiene hypothesis to the worm hypothesis. Charlie never got any worms when he was a kid. And maybe there is some example for it. And there is a very famous paper that showed that if you give people tapeworms, the amount of antihistamines they need for their hay fever goes right down. So it actually works. Tapeworm actually works. And there's a little note on the paper that authors said, the lead authors have now self-infected themselves with tapeworm. I know, it sounds crazy.
This is a sci-fi movie.
We're so off topic. But anyway, this is just my life story. So, yeah, obviously we need to collect more evidence, and we're still learning about why allergies are going through the roof. It does seem to be multifactorial, so exposure as well as perhaps worms, as well as perhaps other factors. Like there was a German study that showed that if you brought in animal skins, like an animal skin rug, reduce the risk of your children developing allergies. And the idea was, it was called ruralization, because we know that people who live in rural communities don't get allergies, but people who live in cities do get allergies. So they try ruralization through bringing in animal skins, which might contain dust and allergies and promote that kind of stuff. And that reduced allergy risk. So it's very complicated. And I did all my research and I feel like I failed my children, because the eldest ended up with a whole bunch of allergies, which was really tough. It was a really tough experience. Anyway, that's very off topic. But that's my life story so far.
And this is why we mentioned to our listeners, go back and listen to the first episode, because there's plenty more goodness in there. All I'm thinking now is all developing natures with itchy bums. So I don't know, Emma, I'll let you
okay. Get us back on track here. Worms do cause itchy bums. They do. Yeah. Tapeworm doesn't, but threadworms do cause itchy butts. And I don't think I want to explain why.
Look, with my own bias, I just latched on to get a dog. Basically, that was my
take. Yeah, get a dog. It's good advice. Get a dog. It's good advice. Yeah.
Speaking of dogs, Adrift Lab have a couple of lab mascots. So that's my segue, Ben.
Yeah. That's a beautiful segue.
Smooth.
Which I apologize, are probably my favorite members of the team. But Jack, you've been a core member of Adrift Lab for a fair few years now. What kind of research are you and the team doing there?
Right. So probably the biggest piece of research that we published recently is we essentially identified what we believe is a completely new disease, and it's called plasticosis. And it sounds like a made-up word, and to be honest, it is a made-up word, but it has a huge grounding in medical language. So osis is a suffix that we apply to fibrotic diseases. And so a fibrotic disease is where your healthy tissues gradually get replaced with scar tissue, which is fibrotic. We kind of understand what that word means. It's a tough tissue, and it's full of a term that we're probably all familiar with, collagen. And collagen is largely a long, strong protein that connects together to sort of build the structure of our body, and cells fill in the gaps. So you can imagine your whole body is a structure of collagen, and the cells are filling in the gaps there. But what happens is, in certain situations, we kill off the cells, and the cells come back, and they grow back, and they divide, and they replace the cells that have died off. And when they do that, they typically actually lay down more collagen. So they lay down even more collagen when they grow back and they come back. And what happens is, the more and more collagen you get, the stiffer the tissue gets, and the less cells that can actually fit in the location where those cells are died can fit. So every time the cells come back, they're putting more collagen down, they're making it more fibrotic, and so it actually fits less cells in. So if you kill the cells again, there's less gaps for those cells to grow back. Now, you are actually all probably familiar with this process, because if you get a scar in your skin just from a cut, you will notice that scar feels a bit bumpy, doesn't stretch the same, it doesn't quite have that same movement as the skin around it. And that's because basically you've killed off a bunch of cells, and they've grown by cutting or scratching or abrasion. And when the cells have grown back, they've laid down more collagen, which is that protein network which cells live within. They've laid down other proteins too, and it creates a fibrotic zone. And sometimes, particularly in young animals and young people, the cells are actually able to eat away some of the collagen and get back to almost brand new. So babies, when they get cuts and stuff, they don't get as scarred and they typically can heal really nicely. But as we get older, we get worse at that remodeling and the scars build up. And so this general term is called osis. And so we have fibrosis, but you will have also heard of cirrhosis. And cirrhosis is this exact process happening in the liver. So if you enjoy your alcohol a bit too much, you kill off all your liver cells. And when they grow back, they lay down more of that collagen and more of those long proteins that build that fibrotic network. And if you keep doing that, then the liver literally gets fibrotic and it runs out of room for your liver cells. So your liver function gets worse and worse and worse. And this is what we see in alcoholics. If you ever want to get scared, you can actually measure this yourself. If you tuck your fingers up under your ribs on the right-hand side, say on a Friday morning, and then on a Sunday morning, after you've had a couple of good weekends on Friday night, Saturday night, you will actually feel that your liver is more rigid. It will have already laid down more collagen, and then it gets remodeled. But the remodeling efficiency is slower as you get older, and so eventually, if you're a chronic alcoholic, you'll need a liver replacement. So that's that osis suffix. And it has also been applied to some substances that we breathe in. So if you breathe in asbestos, also silica dust, this is a very big one at the moment. Cheap kitchen benches are made out of microsilica, and people are getting really horrible diseases from cutting these cheap kitchen benches. And so when we breathe in silica, when we breathe in asbestos, we get that same thing. We kill off our lung cells and they grow back, laying down more collagen, and you end up with more of this fibrous tissue. And you can imagine lungs are supposed to be like sponges, supposed to be very stretchy, very able to expand or contract. But if you increase that rigidity, that's going to be very bad in the lungs. It's bad in the liver, but it's even worse in the lungs. And so this leads to two diseases that have been identified in the 70s and 80s called asbestosis and silicosis. And you'll see that same term, that osis term. Well, we looked in these birds wild birds that we know eat plastic. They just evolved in an environment where if you eat something off the top of the ocean, it's probably either going to be food or benign. So if you're competing with other birds and something floats up to the top of the ocean, you snap it up and get it before the other birds do. And if it's a piece of driftwood, that's fine. That floats, that goes right through you. That's innocuous. If it's a squid, you win, right? So the feeding strategy of eat first, ask questions later works for these seabirds. But, you know, in the past 70 years, we have polluted the ocean with an insane amount of plastic. And so these birds, using the same feeding technique, spot something white or blue that looks like a squid perhaps, and they eat this plastic, and the plastic builds up in their stomach. And we actually track these birds, and they can eventually die from consuming plastic. And so what we did was we took the stomachs of these birds that have died from consuming plastics, and we compared them to birds that have died from other reasons, such as being hit by a car, which does happen, unfortunately. And we did a stain. There's a very cool stain that you can do. It's a very beautiful stain called a trichrome stain that stains for collagen as well as the healthy tissue. So the healthy tissue stains up pink and the collagen stays up a brilliant blue. And you can actually measure the ratio of healthy tissue to collagen. And what we found was there was massive collagen deposition, massive amounts of collagen in the birds that had eaten the plastic. And so it was a fibrotic disease that is getting caused by plastic. And so this is plasticosis, and this is the disease we defined. And it's very scary because I mentioned to you collagen, that amount of collagen is very hard to remodel. So we try and rescue a lot of these birds. And so we go out there and we fill their you can literally feel their stomachs and you can feel the plastic inside their stomach. So most of the time we're trying to save them. So we fill up their stomachs with water and it induces them to vomit. And when they vomit out all the plastic. And we've largely been thinking, yay, we're saving these birds. But if these birds' stomachs are just a fibrotic lump that can't stretch because it's just a fibrotic lump, they can't release their digestive enzymes or digestive juices because the cells have been replaced by collagen, and it's the cells that were producing their digestive juices. We might be sending these birds out, and this is an absolute gutting feeling. We've flushed out the plastic, but we don't know if these birds are functional, and whether they can go and eat fish now. Even though we've cleared them from the plastic and they're a healthy body weight, perhaps they can't. And Jennifer Lavers and Alex Bond are the two, you know, founding mother and father of the Adrift Lab. Just some of the most wonderful people. I cannot rave about them enough, that you will ever meet in your lives. Just the most dedicated scientists, selfless. Anyway, just to give you an idea of how awesome Jen is, a hurricane hit an island of a group of birds that she studied. She got out her credit card, paid for a helicopter, huge amounts of money, to fly out there to see how her birds are doing. That's the kind of person Jen is. Just selfless. Oh, it's unbelievable. But anyway, they have been tracking these birds for 14 years now or so. I might have that number slightly wrong. And they have not seen really any of the plastic impacted birds come back. So even the ones that we were flushing the stomachs out, so they had no plastic in their stomachs. And this plasticosis concept is really explaining this. It's causing a disease that you can't recover from. If we go back to that kitchen bench that I was talking about, the silicosis, young builders were going out there and they were cutting these kitchen benches without proper ventilation, and they were dying 2 months later. And there was nothing we could do. The collagen was gets packed into their lungs, and they can't breathe eventually. And so that seems to be happening to the stomach of these birds. And so the stomach is now non-functional. And it's just devastating. It's devastating.
Just for our listeners, just to bring a bit of tangible perspective to this, when you're flushing the stomachs of these birds, what are the common pieces of plastic that are being brought back up?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's one of those things where what's causing the problems to the birds will be different to what's causing the problems with the fish, because what we see, it's actually the light plastics, the plastics that float. And there's all these plastics that sink, and those will be causing problems on the sea floor. But typically what we see is huge numbers of lids. So lids, Coke bottle lids, milk bottle lids, the polyethylene, and they float exceptionally well. Also, like ice cream containers, they're made out of the same thing. They break down into fragments, they float. And so it's all single-use plastics. There are some things like we see a lot, some industrial plastics, like oyster farms. They use these little plastic discs to space out the oysters, and we see a lot of that because these birds go off and forage off the coast of Sydney where there are a lot of oyster farms, and we see a lot of them. There is a mysterious item that we see all the time, and we've been searching for decades to try find it. We always put that up on Twitter. It's like this cone-shaped piece of plastic with ridges, and we keep... and a lot of stuff, you get mad because there are... It's designed to come off the product. Like, you know, those little plastic things that you have to rip around a lid so that you can unscrew it. Or, you know, the quadrupacks, you know, almond milks. You have to pull out that tab from an almond milk to drink it.
All these things keep us safe, but causing more harm.
I know. But you could really design a lot of these things to not fall off the product, and it would save so many issues. Just keeping the plastic together would save so many issues. But then there are plastics that sink that cause other issues. And we know that there's lots of animals, because every day we're on this island called Lord Howe Island. We go pick up plastics from the beaches as well. And you'll come across an ice cream box, you know, or a milk bottle, and it has triangular bite marks out of it. And those triangular bite marks, we know, are turtles. We know that's the same bite mark that turtles make. So turtles are undoubtedly experiencing this plasticosis phenomenon. And what's a real shame is that both these animals are long-lived animals. So they typically live to 30 years old. So the birds live to 30 years old. The turtles live to hundreds of years old. And so losing an individual is a huge impact on the population. Compared to faster animals that produce 10,000 eggs, you know, a season, their recovery is a lot better from incidences like this compared to these slow animals that normally take care of their young. They raise one young at a time. You know, it's so devastating for their population to be caught up in this thing that has nothing to do with them, you know, plastic pollution.
And just to give the listener some context, like reading the introduction of your paper, like you're citing another paper that's estimating that the global marine plastic load is between 15 to 51 trillion pieces. So that's just incomprehensibly huge.
Yeah.
But it's something unique to the plastic, is it? That's like the inflammatory process is unique to the plastic? Because I remember you saying last time that you were on that you had control birds where they had pumice rock in their stomachs and it didn't cause the same inflammation. So it's not just there's something hard that's kind of irritating the gut.
100%. And out of these birds eat squid. That's one of their primary things. And you can pull out squid beaks that are incredibly sharp. Like I could draw blood with these beaks that we pull out of the stomachs. And they're sometimes like as big as your thumb and there's no damage on the birds. And so it's not, your intuition is that something spiky going in there and poking the stomachs, but these birds actually evolved to eat spiky things. They had this whole organ called a gizzard that can grind up a squid beak into powder. And so they have evolved eating that. So it's something different. And that's probably where the next research is going to go, because what I believe is largely happening, and the evidence is starting to point to this more, is that the large pieces of plastic are shedding microplastics. So they're eating a Coke bottle lid, which is relatively smooth on all different angles. The one thing I'll say as well, one of the very disappointing things about the plasticosis paper was we found that So in biology, there's many different kinds of relationships you can have between two variables. The most common relationship you would imagine is a linear relationship. So as plastic goes up, as you get one piece, two piece, three piece, the damage goes up, you know, grade one damage, grade two damage, grade three damage. But we didn't see that. We actually saw a log linear relationship or a curved relationship where one piece of plastic was causing, say, 50% of maximum damage. Two pieces of plastic was causing 80% of maximum damage. Three pieces of plastic, you're at 100% maximum damage of plasticosis. And then 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you're still at 100%. So what we saw was actually relatively a few pieces of plastic was able to cause the maximum amount of damage that we could see. And that again supports that it's not pokey bits of plastic. It's that the smooth plastic that's in their stomach is actually releasing lots of microplastics. And these microplastics are actually smaller than a cell. And it can get into the cell and cause a huge problem. And once stuff starts to get into cells, it's a real step change. I keep going back to this, those kitchen benches. So Aboriginal people have been exposed to silica for 70,000 years living in the outback. And the sand in the outback is a very fine silica. But Aboriginal people do fine, you know, out there. They don't die in 2 months after being exposed to that sand. What the problem was, they made these kitchen benches out of microsilica, and the powdered silica they were putting in there was smaller than a human cell. So now a few breaths of this after you cut it, to install someone's kitchen bench, was killing tradies, young 20-year-old tradies, 2 months later. Australia has now banned those benches. I'm not sure the status in New Zealand. I know they're still sold in America. So the key point there is that the size is critical. The grains of sand in the outback are of the size that much bigger than a cell, and a human body can handle that to a certain extent. Like, it's still not great to get sand in your lungs, but it's much less damaging than something very tiny that can get inside a cell. And so that's what we think is largely happening, is the plastics are shedding microplastics. And we've got a study showing that the more macroplastics, the more large plastics we find in the stomach of the birds, the more microplastics we find in the liver and the kidney and the spleen of the birds. So there's a correlation there to show that potentially the large plastics are shedding microplastics. Now, Emma, you mentioned that famous 50 trillion pieces of microplastics paper. All I can say is that's probably a massive, massive, massive underestimate. There was a paper that showed that a single cup of tea contains 2 billion microplastics. And that's because the tea bag is made out of polyethylene and was shedding microplastics. So using that maths, you could roughly double the amount of microplastics in the ocean with about 1,000 cups of tea. That doesn't seem right, does it? There's something missing. And it's that 50 trillion is looking somewhere between 1 millimeter or 5 millimeters and above. So that's how many pieces of plastic there are. That's their lower threshold. But we consistently find, and we've shown this in the birds and in water and in poo, you get more plastics the smaller you look. And it makes sense, right? One large bit of plastic will break into 2 medium bits, which will break into 4 smaller bits, which will eventually, you know, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, keeps going up exponentially. So the number of, you know, 10 micron plastics, 1 micron plastics, which is the real damaging range, 1 to 10. Nanoplastics are a whole other phenomenon that we're trying to figure out right now, but the 1 to 10 microns are so damaging, yet that's probably the most common kind of plastic, way more common than the 1 millimeter plastic in the ocean. So I said I wouldn't terrify you, but I think I've already done that. I'm so sorry.
Now, the next obvious question that we want to ask is, okay, so what is the impact? What is the problem with microplastic in our system? But I'll push pause on that and pivot a little and ask the question first, information. How does information work in our bodies? Because it'll come back to this. So can you talk to us a little bit about the whole information?
Okay. So inflammation, right? We kind of intuitively know what it is. It's that swelling, it's the redness, it's the really fast response. But there's a much better way to think about it, right? So you guys know that our immune system can learn, right? And so that's why we take vaccines, because if we take a vaccine, we expose our immune system to a little bit of a disease, and then our body learns to then react to the virus or the bacteria. And so now we can attack it as soon as it enters our body. This is called the adaptive immune system. And the thing about it is it's really slow. So your body needs to take a piece and it needs to go find, there's only a couple of cells in your body that might be able to kill, say, SARS-CoV-2, you know, COVID-19. So what happens is an immune cell in your body eats the vaccine, gets the little protein, and it goes all around our body trying to find that those 1 or 2 or 3 or 5 immune cells that can actually attack that disease. It's basically holding up a wanted poster saying, can you get this guy? And the immune cell's like, yeah, no, I can't. And then eventually it'll find that 1 or 2 or 5 immune cells that can actually kill it. And then that one immune cell that has the ability to wipe out that virus will then divide and then wipe out the virus. So when you get a cold and it takes 3 to 4 days to clear, this is what's happening, right? Your body is doing that. But that's too slow, right? Bacteria and viruses would probably kill you if that's the entire system we relied on, right? So instead we rely on another system called the innate immune system. And it is a crude system, but it works, right? And basically what the innate immune system does is it has a bunch of ways to detect if either there's any kind of virus or any kind of bacteria in your body, or is there tissue damage in your body with no explanation? Because if there's tissue damage in your body with no explanation, that kind of means you might have an infection, you just haven't detected it yet. And what the innate immune system then does is it just goes in and it kills everything. It sounds weird, but one of your main innate immune cells is called neutrophils, and they pump out a protein that produces bleach. And this is chemically identical to household bleach in your body, and it sterilizes the whole area. And the idea is we're just going to kill whatever's there, right? Let's just kill whatever's there and we'll hope for the best. And let's just either kill it immediately, and a lot of bacteria and viruses that aren't especially evolved to get us, to get the human, you know, a disease our dog might have, they can be easily dealt with the innate immune system. But there's some diseases that have evolved to get around our innate immune system, and that's the one where the adaptive immune system has to come in. And so the innate immune system is trying with these really crude techniques to keep everything at bay. But you can see that that's not great. So if your innate immune system is constantly going off, spraying the bleach, they also eat cells. So your innate immune cells will come around and start eating cells because maybe that cell is producing viruses, because your viruses reprogram our cells to create more viruses. So your innate immune system might just go kill cells, eat cells, produce bleach, produce hydrogen peroxide. They produce enzymes that just chop up everything. And so it's a very damaging process, but it's a very necessary process, and it keeps a lot of pathogens at bay, and it gives our adaptive immune system to learn and find those immune cells that can kill that pathogen to expand up, you know, that very slow process. So that's the innate immune system. You can imagine that's a good thing until it's going off all the time. If it's chronic, you know, and actually this is going back to, this is a great, thank you for bringing this up, Ben, is that by killing all those cells with the bleach and causing the tissue damage, the next response is fibrosis. So the next response is to lay down the collagen, seal that off, and then maybe the cells can come back later once everything is calmed down. So inflammation and fibrosis are very intrinsically linked, right? So a smoker will have a very fibrotic lungs and also a very inflamed lungs, and the inflammation is starting to contribute to the tissue damage, which then leads to fibrosis. It's all highly linked. So inflammation is something we need to really have a healthy level, and we don't want chronic inflammation. If it's constantly going, you know, that's a bleach constantly being produced, doesn't sound like a good thing for your body, does it? If it's chronic, or if it's excessive, you know, if it's too much, then yeah, it can obviously cause a huge problem if you have a massive excessive inflammatory response. And we see that in diseases like sepsis is where your bloodstream and your whole body is infected with a pathogen. Suddenly you end up with inflammation across your entire body, and your entire vasculature, your blood vessels, becomes leaky, because you know how your ankle swells up when you roll your ankle? That's because your blood vessels have become leaky because of inflammation. Imagine your whole body becoming leaky. Suddenly your blood is just seeping out of your blood vessels, and your blood pressure starts to drop. You imagine if you've got no blood in your blood vessels, the pressure drops, and so your heart beats faster to try to get that pressure up. So yeah, inflammation is everyone says it's a double-edged sword. It's killing bacteria, it's killing fungus, killing viruses, but it's also killing us. And so you've got to be careful and control it.
Bring it back to the original question I was going to ask. Now understanding the impacts of inflammation, good and bad, is the impact of microplastic on the human system.
Yeah, so we have in our body this thing that's essentially is called a particle response. And so you can imagine immune cells are little spheres that wander around our body. And when they see a pathogen or some tissue damage, what they'll do is they'll eat it. So they'll envelop it. And they don't open up, because if they opened up, everything inside the cell would leak. It would be like popping a balloon. They don't do that. What they do is imagine like gradually pushing a tennis ball into a balloon. The balloon will gradually surround the tennis ball. And then imagine once it gets all the way around, imagine if the balloon had the ability to then just bud off. And so now you have the tennis ball surrounded by balloon material inside the balloon. That's basically how an immune cell goes around eating things. And that's sort of basically what it means is when it eats something, it's surrounded by what's called the membrane, the outer layer of the immune cell. Now we have what's called a particulate response, and that's when, what happens if you eat something that you can't digest? If you're an immune cell, you get indigestion, you eat something you can't digest, that particle is going to sit inside the cell forever. And perhaps it might even start to poke holes in the membrane it's in. And so if it was that tennis ball surrounded by the balloon material, what if the tennis ball eventually poked through the balloon material and it's now just inside the cell? It's in the balloon. It's not wrapped in anything. It's just starting to float around, and that's going to cause huge problems. So we have a bunch of proteins that are designed to recognize when the stomach of the cell has been popped. And if the stomach of the cell has been popped, it initiates a massive inflammatory response. And you might say, why? Why would it do that? Wouldn't it just maybe just kill itself or something like that? Well, it turns out there's a bunch of sneaky bacteria that have figured out that they can get eaten by an immune cell and then escape through the stomach and then eat the cell from the inside out. Listeria is one of these. So bacteria can do that. And so the immune system learned to detect when its stomach was getting popped, and then it had assumed, maybe I've got one of those really invasive bacteria. Uh-oh, I've got to respond to this. I've got to initiate a massive inflammatory response because I might be getting in from the inside out right now. So our immune cells evolved to detect when a particle is trying to escape the stomach of the cell, and they think it's a bacteria. Now, I've shown plastics escape very easily. And it's because, this is a little bit complicated, but oils don't dissolve in water. We know that, right? You know, when you make a curry, the oil layer is on the top. Well, the membrane of the cell is made out of oil, and the inside of the cell is made out of water. And so the inside can't flow outwards because there's that oil barrier, right? And so essentially, oils can get through oils and dissolve in oils and push through oils, and water can water soluble things like juice or, you know, vodka can dissolve in water. But well, the stomach of the cell is made out of oil, it's made out of that membrane, and so is plastic. So plastic is also made out of oil. And so it can actually push through these membranes. It doesn't have those same issues that, say, a piece of silica might have. Silica doesn't get out of the stomach of the cell in that same way. It can't just kind of glide through a membrane. And this is probably why we're finding microplastics everywhere. We're finding it in placentas, in human brains, in kidneys and livers and spleens. We're finding them everywhere. Our body isn't designed to have barriers to stop this kind of oily particle slipping through everything. So these microplastics seem to slip out of the stomach of the cell, initiating that massive inflammatory response, which recruits those cells that pump out bleach, which then causes tissue damage, which then causes fibrosis, and then we end up with that sort of permanent response going on. And it's very scary. It's pretty scary.
So I know we're still at the beginning stages of the research, and our understanding is obviously going to grow. So I don't want to, like, unfairly extrapolate your words here or put words into your mouth that you're not actually saying. But if this chronic plastic exposure results in plasticosis in seabirds, what do you think the findings could mean in terms of translating it to other wildlife and us? Like, are we eventually, do you think, with the massive amounts of plastic that are in the world, we're going to get to the stage where we're seeing the same kind of fibrotic formations within the human gut potentially?
I definitely think so. I think it's going to happen, and you don't. This is drawing a long bow, so I don't want anyone to think that this evidence is concrete. But things like Crohn's and IBS, the rates of those are going through the roof. I mentioned allergies; the rates of allergies are going through the roof as well, and the burden of chronic disease is going up and up and up. I mean, for the first time in forever, in the last 60 years, life expectancies are starting to turn down. And so, and there's a lot of factors in there, air pollution, diet, everything like that. But I think plastics is adding another weight to the world. And you mentioned wildlife. It's undoubtedly, we just wrote a paper called The Global Experiment. We're essentially doing a global experiment. We're saying, what does plastic exposure do to every living thing on the planet? We're doing that right now, and we're finding out. And we're finding out it's not great, and that's unfortunate because we love wildlife, and we love us, and we're on the planet. And we're doing this experiment on us. The barriers to creating a new chemical or a new product and then putting it into society are zero. They are retroactive. Basically, you create a brand new package, away you go. I've just created a new biodegradable water bottle. There we go. I'm going to go sell that. There's no one stopping me from doing that. What has happened next is a health consequence from it. these Stanley Cups. I don't know if you've heard of these Stanley Cups. They turned out they were full of lead. You know, it's always retroactive. It goes out, and it's not until we discover the negative effects that we can pull it back. And so we are performing this massive experiment on ourselves. And it's going to be hard to pick out the plastic effects because we're also doing pollution and bad diet, refined sugars. You know, we're performing a million experiments on us simultaneously, and it's going to be hard to isolate it. There's a study that I would love to do, but it's really hard to get off the ground because this is where a lot of the asbestos research came from, is go look at industry workers. I would love to go to Bangladesh and compare the people working in clothes factories that are plastic, that undoubtedly the air is just full to the brim of plastics, and compare that to the cotton workers or the wool workers. What's happening to the lungs of these people that are working in these atrocious conditions? So I would love to do that experiment. That'd be a really hard one to get off the ground, but I think that's the kind of thing that we need. Like, we found out asbestos caused lung cancer and asbestosis by looking at asbestos miners, you know, and we found out about silicosis by looking at the people who cut kitchen benches. I think there's real room to do that big study where we look at, because you and I have been exposed to the same amount of plastics, which is a lot, unfortunately, but we've been exposed to the same amount. There's virtually no one that has been exposed to almost no plastics. So we're going to need to find those extreme cases, those people that are really, really exposed to microplastics, to start to draw out some of those, pick apart how much is microplastics contributing to the rise of chronic disease in humans.
Following on from your mention of the global experiment paper, I mean, you've said, you know, physical and chemical pollutants are basically ever present in the world, that the exposure to them is unavoidable. But in that paper, reading that, it made me so mad because the research funding for from the National Research Council is dedicated to pollution-focused research is so ridiculously low. It's
a fraction of a percent.
So that's a huge hurdle.
Yeah.
And then if you're focusing in on wildlife, it's even worse. But that's a huge hurdle to begin with. But in that paper, you're talking about the ethical imperative for an interdisciplinary approach. And I think Adrift Lab does a really fantastic they're a fantastic example of that. So that interdisciplinary approach working really well. But why do you think that that's a key kind of approach that we need to overcome those huge barriers such as the lack of funding?
Yeah, oh man, that's a big question. I could really jump into that a lot. But okay, so why do we need interdisciplinary? Well, a classic example would be the Adrift Lab had been researching the negative impacts on these birds, you know, for 8-9 years before I joined them. I'd been working on pathology, looking in human samples and animal samples, in which the pathology was either a human disease or in which we'd actually induced the disease in the mouse. So I actually gave mouse and rat stroke, for example, or we used a genetic model of Alzheimer's disease or sepsis and that kind of thing. Honestly, it's not fun, but it's one of those necessary things at the moment. And we opened up our first bird in our collaboration. So I come to the island, I've been researching microplastics in cells and mice. We come to the island, we open up the first bird's stomach that had died from plastic, and I look at it and I say, that is inflamed. And they go, how do you know? And they didn't know that because they haven't lived their lives in pathology. They lived their lives on how do you count birds accurately? How do you measure the birds accurately? How do you count and measure plastics accurately? What are plastics doing to the ecology? You know, they looked at slugs in the colony because the birds were coming and vomiting up plastic, and then the slugs were being exposed to the plastic and stuff like that. So each human can only build enough knowledge in a very narrow domain. It's very hard to be the jack of all trades and be an expert at counting birds, measuring birds, going out at night, getting the permits, going all over the world to the islands and quantifying plastics, and become a pathology expert in the immune system. That's impossible. So what we need is the collaborations between those expertise. So when I came there, we've immediately made these big discoveries because of the pioneering work of Jen and Alex, and then me bringing in that different perspective. We've been able to discover and describe plasticosis, to demonstrate that macroplastics are releasing microplastics into these birds, and to demonstrate this massive loss of function, and the inflammation that was going on. The stomach, just to describe it, it was glossy and kind of puffy. And unless you've seen a lot of that. You can't spot it, but I could spot it the second they opened it up that it was glass. And we did an experiment on the spot. I was like, I came up with it and we did it on the spot. And that was, you take a sample of tissue, you weigh it, then you leave it for a week to dry, then you weigh it again. And that tells you how much water was in the tissue. Now, I mentioned during inflammation, your blood leaks, and so water rushes into the tissue. And we immediately established that plastic was causing the tissue to clog up with water and blood, which is a sign of inflammation. There was way more water in the stomachs of in the stomach tissue of the birds with plastic than non-plastic. And it immediately says inflammation's going on. And it's only through cross-collaboration that we can say that. And just to touch on the ethical imperative, because now my entire research is not using animals like mice and rats. I've completely moved away from that. And that's because I mentioned we are doing those experiments. We're exposing our animals, our wildlife, to plastic, to chemicals, to forest fire smoke, to car smoke. We are doing all of those experiments. The problem is we're not measuring their outcomes. Now imagine how mad you would be at a scientist. Imagine my PhD, I give a whole bunch of rats stroke, and I give half of them cannabinoid marijuana-like substances, half of them placebo, then I don't measure the outcome. I don't measure it. So all I've done is just taken a bunch of animals, essentially caused a disease in them, and then didn't measure it. Everyone would say, that's the most unethical thing you can do in the world. Well, that's what we're doing right now. We are exposing all wildlife to plastics, ever-increasing amounts of plastics, and we are largely not measuring the consequences of that. And I think that that's very unethical. Yet there are labs right now that are taking healthy mice and exposing them to plastic. So they're now exposing more animals to plastic to measure their outcomes. Now, there is some benefit to that. You get to isolate what's exactly going on. But there's actually a lot of cons to that. And let me just tell you too, really quickly, is they always use pristine lab-bought plastic. And that's because you want it to be repeatable. You want another scientist to be able to buy those plastics and do that exact same experiment. But those plastics don't have colorants, don't have plasticizers, they don't have any of the hardening agents, they haven't been exposed to UV, they haven't been exposed to the ocean and the heavy metals. Jen and Alex have shown that plastics soak up heavy metals while they're in the ocean. So they're not real plastics. But then it gets even worse. These mice are kept in incredibly hygienic conditions. They're called specific pathogen-free mice. And because of that, their immune systems are weird, to the point that if you take out their lymph nodes, which are, you know, those bumps under your neck when you get sick, those are your lymph nodes. That's where a lot of your immune system lives, in those lymph nodes. If you were to look at a lymph node of a lab mouse, it looks nothing like a lymph node from a human or a wild mouse. Or my birds, or the birds on the island, the flesh-footed shearwaters. And that's because it's never been exposed to pathogens, really. And so its immune system is completely naive. And so, and people do these studies. I actually have a friend that went out to Skye Island in Scotland, which has a huge infestation of wild mice. But I actually think they're native, so it's fine. But there's just a lot of mice there. And she compared the immune systems of the wild mice to the immune systems of the mice in the labs, and said it's completely different. It's night and day. Like, studying those mice immune system may have very limited applicability to these wild mice that have constantly being exposed to pathogens. She did say it was a bit weird sleeping in a sleeping bag and mice just jumping all over you. She couldn't keep them out of the tent when she was doing that study. So by investigating wildlife, we're looking at real plastics with real animals that have a real exposure to and a real immune system. And we don't have to induce an additional suffering. In fact, we reduce the suffering because we are taking birds that some of these birds wash up on the beach. They've tried to take flight, but they're too sick. And so they wash up on the beach, which is absolutely heartbreaking. And we pick them up and they're half the weight they're supposed to. They don't have any flight feathers, so they cannot take flight. That's why they keep getting washed out into the ocean. And we pick them up and we actually have ethics to euthanize them. Otherwise, they're just going to get eaten alive by crabs at that point. And then the plastics are going to continue throughout the ecology because the crabs will get exposed to the plastics and everything like that. So taking them off the beach and ending their lives a little bit earlier is actually probably a bit more humane. And we do try to rescue those birds by flushing the plastics as well if they're healthy, but we're still not sure if that's really the right thing to do. We really don't know because they don't come back. They've probably got plasticosis. They seem healthy, so it seems wrong to kill them. Do we just give them that chance to go out? I don't know. That's a real tough one.
Now, since our last chat, I know a number of us, me included, did a massive clean out. Stainless steel, glass, panic mode. Plastic's bad for us, but it's still everywhere and it's still near impossible to avoid it, whether it's clothing still that we wear to pollution.
Yeah.
But another area that no one's really thought about, and you kind of touched on it now, is in the lab. And you're trying to do all these experiments and assessments and comparisons, but there's contamination now as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so we wanted to do a formal experiment to see where is plastic contamination coming from. So this is actually a really important point to cover. So when you do the experiment correctly, right, what you might do, for example, is say we are dissecting these birds, right? When we open them up, they've got wet tissue, and wet tissue sticks dust, right? And we're taking these organs out, and we're putting them in a container. What container do we put them in? I don't know. You know, should I put them in a glass one? Should I put them in a plastic one? And then we go digest that organ and we count the microplastics. Now, there are lots of sources of plastics from outside the bird that was never part of their pathology getting into those samples. So what's the most important thing? The most important thing you do is you run a control. So, for example, we dissect up a wet piece of paper towel. And we then place that wet piece of paper towel in the same tube that we place in the same kind of tube that we were placing the organs in. We then digest up that paper towel and we then count the microplastics in that paper towel. And we consider that our blank. That should measure the amount of contamination. It might slightly overestimate it because the paper towel itself might contain microplastics. It's obviously very difficult. But then what you do is you count all the microplastics, and if you get 100 microplastics in the organ and 30 microplastics on your paper towel, you know that 30 microplastics were probably introduced during the processing of it. And so then you would subtract that number off that. Now, this is a huge warning to everyone. There is microplastics research that is literally funded by newspapers, like The Guardian, for example, or... and they just get a lab to go count some microplastics in something. Go get bottled water, count the microplastics. And often, not always, often, you'll read the methods, they won't have a blank control. So they've just gone out and counted the microplastics. And you will 100% always get microplastics. We literally cannot generate a sample that doesn't contain microplastics. We have tried. We have a super filtration machine called a MilliQ, which takes distilled water and puts it through all these high-pressured filters. And it uses a bunch of other technology as well, synthetic membranes and all sorts of things to purify the water. We take that water and we run it to our machine, because if you walk it to the machine, it accumulates microplastics as you walk. So we run it to the machine and we measure it. And we will still be
running in the lab, Jack.
I know, I shouldn't. I fast walk. You know those Olympic walkers? I swear, I always have one foot on the ground. Don't tell my lab manager. Anyway, we shuffle. We shuffle to the machine and we measure it. And it will have something in the region of 20 particles per liter just by doing that in that amount of time. If we take tap water, you know, it's got 2,000 particles per liter. So it's very hard to actually generate a zero, to zero your machine and make it understand what a zero looks like. So we run these blanks, and so the most important thing is to run their blanks. It almost doesn't matter how you do it. Like, you could imagine, you know, say you get 100 in your tissue and 90 in your blank. That means you're producing a lot in your blanks, and you'll want to run a lot of blanks because you need to be very sure of that number. But if you get 90, 90, 90, 90, 90, and 100 in your tissue, you can be fairly confident that 10 of those were in your tissue and 90 came from the contamination. So it almost doesn't matter how you do it as long as you run excellent controls. And a lot of these Daily Mail kind of articles don't run those controls. And so sometimes you'll read a paper, you know, there's a million microplastics in your bottle of water, and you go in and read the methods and they haven't run the proper controls. And you get a little bit disappointed because you're like, I believe that there are thousands of microplastics in that bottle of water, but you've done your experiment so wrong that I don't want to criticize it publicly because then everyone thinks, oh, it's fake, don't worry about microplastics. But it is an issue in the field, so you've always got to keep an eye out for those ones. There was another study that looked at, they actually did the opposite. They looked at human blood, and they concluded that 75% of people had microplastics in their blood. And I was like, that just can't be right, because we're all breathing it in every day. It's got to be 100% of humans. There's not a single, you would have to live in a wood hut, in the middle of nowhere, never go in a mall, never go into a hospital, never go into anywhere that has nylon carpet, which is the most common kind of carpet in the world, never wear any of the clothes because most of them are polystyrene. It would just be impossible to have zero in your blood. But I look at their controls, and what they did was they took water and they said that that was their blank, and then the blood was their real sample. And so then whatever level of plastics they found in the water, in the blood, they subtracted what they found in the water. But the blood wasn't mixed with that water. That water isn't an accurate control for the blood. An empty tube would have been the correct control, because you've taken an empty tube, you've put human blood in. No water has gone into that tube. So you've kind of, what you could have done is maybe add a mil of water to the human blood and then compared that to just a mil of water. That would have been a good control. But we know that water contains a lot of microplastics. So now the 25% of humans that had no microplastics in their blood probably just had a microplastics level that was equal or slightly lower to tap water, which is quite high. So it's a very careful procedure. This kind of research requires delicate feet and a lot of thought about how to do your blanks. So we wanted to publish a paper saying, where are the microplastics coming from when you do these experiments? And we thought, oh, this is going to be great. We'll show that glassware is awesome, and we'll show that plasticware is bad, so you should do all your experiments in glass. We wanted to show that you should use a clean hood and not do it on the bench. So a hood is something that sterilizes the air in the area that you're working so that there's no dust or anything in that air. We wanted to show that you should use the purest millicube water, and we wanted to show that you should use tinfoil. You should cover all your samples in tinfoil. And we completely disproved our own theory. The glass and the tinfoil were probably the two greatest sources of microplastics, and the plastic containers actually generated very little microplastics contamination in your samples. So we actually recommend going forward, and weirdly enough, working on a regular bench, lab bench, introduced the same amount of microplastics as the sterile hood. And you might go, okay, well, Jack, how could any of this be true? Well, you kind of need to understand the manufacturing. Glass is just manufactured, put in cardboard boxes, and then shipped to you. So you get the cardboard box, it just sits there on the shelf for weeks, it's not airtight, and then you take that glassware out and you use it. So that's typically how the glassware is used. I will say we did rinse our glassware in our most pure water as well. But glass, anyone knows that glass attracts dust. Anyone who's done the household chores knows that glass attracts dust. And dust in the lab is a huge proportion of plastic in the dust in the air. Now, the plastic tubes are manufactured in a clinical grade factory in which the air is purified, it's sterilized, it's put in a Ziploc bag, and then it sits in that airtight Ziploc bag. There can't be, in these tubes, there can't be any bacteria, any viruses, any fungus, because these tubes are used to prepare drugs and prepare things that we inject into human bodies. So the manufacturing standards for these plasticware is incredibly high. You cannot allow any contaminants to come out of that. And so what we found was that the plasticware introduced far fewer microplastics than the glassware. Tinfoil was terrible. I don't know if it's the static. I don't know what it is, but it just attracted microplastics out of nothing. So why the hood? Why would working in a sterile hood not be better than working on the bench? Well, the hood, because it's so small, is actually a very windy area. Basically, it sucks air in, it filters it, and then it blows that filtered air out onto your samples. And that way, that air is sterile and shouldn't have any dust or any particles in it. And then you put your hands in, which probably have microplastics on it, and then you start pipetting and doing various lab works in that hood. The wind is going to blow all sorts of stuff off your hands, off the equipment, off everything, and just kick everything up. And so it seemed like the benefits of having the filtered air and the cons of having turbulent air sort of balanced out, and we ended up with the same amount of particulate contamination on the bench, which had very still air, versus in the sterile, small sterile hood with very blowy air. I actually managed to get a risk assessment form that lets me work without gloves on in the lab. And everywhere I walk, everyone's like looking at me like, who's this person? But I have to follow this. I walk around like a doctor holding my hands up and backing my way through doors because I'm not allowed to touch anything other than the set equipment for microplastics research. Because the gloves, you know, the term plastic is actually really hard to define, but rubber is essentially plastic. Latex gloves, nitrile gloves, all those gloves are basically a form of plastic. Yeah. So wearing gloves is a problem too.
So for our listeners that work in a lab, cool. Yeah, they're sorted. But for the majority that might be a little bit confused now, go back to plastic Tupperware or just stick with glass. Okay, plastics everywhere.
Yep.
Three top tips of how to, we can't avoid it. But we can minimize, right? So three practical ways in our daily lives, can we reduce the risk of ingesting plastic, basically? But we still want to go outside and we still want to live normal lives. So,
damn, I was going to say, you know, the Aboriginal people had it right. let's go back to nature. I mean, seriously. Okay, tip number one is clothing. Clothing is definitely the number one secret source of microplastics. Every time you take your shirt off, put it back on, you're puffing up microplastics. And you don't know that it's plastic. You're like, oh, this feels like cotton. But like every tracksuit is plastic. And related to that, this is for the parents out there, soft toys. Soft toys are microplastic factories. Like they are just made out of microplastics, the very fine, fluffy stuff. And so you've just got, please, please avoid that. The kids are sucking on it and hugging it all day. If you're a parent, please avoid that. I actually have, when my kid drank milk, he was given milk by his daycare. He had an anaphylactic shock and they put him in the ambulance. And the ambulance driver gave him a stuffed teddy bear. And it was very nice. And that made him feel better on the way to the hospital. And he named it Harvey immediately, and he loved it. But it was made out of plastic. And so what I did was, probably can't tell my kids this, what I did was I took a photo of it, and I put it up on a Facebook knitting person's community board. And I said, hey, guys, my kid fell in love with this, but it's plastic, and we're trying to avoid plastic. Can anyone make me one out of wool and fill it full of wool? And I had three old ladies come and knit him replicas of that. And so that's what I'll say is that virtually the only way to get a non-plastic soft toy is to engage the knitting community. They're out there doing God's work, and get natural wool knitted soft toys for your kids. And wood toys, you know, we pulled out a piece of Lego from one of these birds, and it was an astronaut. And we had a volunteer named Paul, and he's excellent at identifying plastic pollution. They stopped producing this toy in 1976. So this plastic might have killed several birds. Because once the bird dies, it rots around the plastic and the plastic can wash back out to oceans. But the point is, this piece of plastic has been around for nearly 50 years and it managed to kill a bird 50 years later after being created. And so my mother literally says it's child abuse to not give your kids Lego, but I'm refusing to give my kids Lego just because that's a forever plastic. Every piece of plastic is virtually forever. And when are we going to stop? Are we going to stop producing Lego once the surface of the earth is covered in Lego? Like, we need to start making those wise decisions away from that. But definitely in terms of ingestion, it's clothing and it's soft toys and it's bedding and it's carpet that I think are the number ones. I think single-use bottles are terrible. They probably do release microplastics into the bottle. The longer they sit on the shelf, probably the more plastics that are being released. But I don't think those same levels would compare to clothing. I think we're talking 10 times, 100 times difference in magnitude. On that, do you want to hear the grossest study ever published? This is going to make you feel bad. I'm telling you.
Can't get any worse there, Jack.
Oh, it's about to get worse. Are you ready? So they published, people had published case reports saying that when people got IV bags, they reported a bad taste in their mouth. So people started to do studies and found that the longer the IV bag sat on the shelf, the worse the taste in the mouth people reported and the more frequently they did. And then these people used the gases from what people were breathing out, and they put that into a machine called a mass spec spectrometer, which is able to identify chemicals, basically found that the IV bags were leaching plasticizers into the IV. It was going around your blood, and then you were breathing it out in your lungs, this volatile plastic chemical compound, and that's what was causing the bad taste in your mouth. So, yeah, that's the worst study I've ever read. It was really good. It was well-controlled, that study. It was a fantastic study. So that's an example of plastics shedding. That's the other note I would say, is there's a whole other field of research about the nasty chemicals that plastics release, and that's not my main field. And so if you're doing that kind of research, you have to use glass containers, because the plastic containers themselves that you tried to put your chemicals into would start to leach these chemicals into it. So it's a whole other avenue, is that you can consider plastics as a delivery mechanism for a wide range of toxic chemicals that, trust me, have never... People were concerned that the vaccines had no longitudinal studies. Virtually every chemical you've ever been exposed to has had zero long-term studies. All the plasticizers, all the colorants that they put in have had no long-term studies in humans. What are you, crazy? But you're undoubtedly ingesting it and even injecting it when you get an IV bag. Yeah. I'm sorry. I don't know. I don't have any good news. I've got no good news for you.
Again, the irony is something that's potentially saving your life is potentially now killing you.
Yeah. I mean,
if you're breathing it out, it's almost like your chimney stack of a factory. You know, it's all those toxic fumes. And
you can't tell me it's not of a biologically relevant level if you can taste it. That means it's activating receptors on your taste buds. That is a biologically relevant concentration. It's activating receptors. By definition, we've got a physiological response, which is taste. And so who knows what else those chemicals will be doing. And it shows kind of the nasty nature of some of these chemicals, because they can bind to the receptors in your body. These chemicals have taste, so they can obviously bind to receptors. There's problems with estrogen receptor activation and all sorts of stuff. So it's a bleak outlook.
We've spoken about the importance, when I say important, the benefits that plastic has provided us with. You know, what else would you put a vial of, you know, a sort of pint of blood in to transport to a clinic, a hospital, whatever the case is? I mean, there will be and can be other solutions, but glass, we're manufacturing more glass. We know, you've got to mine more deserts or floor beds or...
Yeah, river mouths are a big one. They just go in.
Yeah, so every...
And you've got to heat it up.
Yeah.
You got to melt the sand. It's huge energy. Yeah, glass. Yeah. And then you've got to transport it. And then the transporting glass compared to transporting plastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got that CO2 problems.
We know plastic is a big component of our over-consuming society. Sort of consumption has been a very common thread in our conversations in the more latter years of doing this podcast. So everything goes back to that. Do we need kids to have 100 toys? 10 is fine. So even if it's 10 plastic toys as opposed to 100, well, there's still a benefit there, perhaps, because we're reducing. Should we be drinking water from a bottle? In some countries, unfortunately, yes. Or some parts of Australia, New Zealand, yes, we actually have to drink bottled water because tap water is just not safe or drinkable. And that's unfortunately just the repercussions of so many other factors. It's not just looking at one area. So to start wrapping things up, because let's get a little positive here. Future projects, yourself, the wonderful team at Drift Lab, who we will continue to have on the show over the course of this podcast. What's next? What else are you looking at? What more depressing research are you lining up?
Oh, I really don't want to tell you this one. So previous research is focused on animals that had died from plastic consumption. We wanted to know what was happening in the animals that had a light exposure, they weren't too bad, and they've got a healthy body weight, they've got good bill size, good wings, everything. You couldn't tell that they had eaten plastic from looking at them. So we wanted to know, and to do that, we have to use a less invasive technique. We can't just kill healthy birds. So we were taking blood samples, and there's a technique that you can use which basically evaluates around about what's happening with around about 1,000 proteins. It's called proteomics, and proteins are basically the functional unit of your body. They do everything almost. And so the proteins that circulate around your blood can tell us heaps about what's happening in your body. So we got healthy birds that were above 600, 700 grams, which is a healthy weight. And we got two identical populations. So they're healthy, their wingspan's the same, their bill length is the same, they've got the good wing, they've got the good feathers, they've got, you know, the right body weight. And the only difference is there's a few bits of plastic in these guys and no plastic in those guys. When we get them to vomit by giving them the water, take a small blood sample, measure their proteins. I was worried, right? Because when you do a study, there's type A studies, which is no matter what result you get, it's interesting. There's type B studies, when you get a certain result, it's interesting. When you don't get a certain result, it's not that interesting. And a type C study, no matter what you do, you're not finding out anything. You want to avoid those ones. But I felt like this was a type B study, because if we didn't find something, your blood actually contains around 2 million proteins, or maybe 1 million proteins, and we can only measure sort of 1,000 of the most abundant ones. And so if we didn't see a difference between the plastic birds and the no plastic birds, it's probably that we're seeing differences in proteins that are in the less abundant area. So we haven't discovered anything. For example, all the inflammatory signaling molecules are at levels below the detection limit of this method. So we wouldn't see inflammation. So I was nervous going into the study. Well, we managed to measure around about 850 proteins, and 250 of them were significantly different in the plastic-affected birds. That is nowhere near what I thought we were going to see. And what you can then do is you can imagine these 1,000 proteins go up, go down. You get a little bit of a signature. If you imagine it almost like a sound wave, some of the proteins went up, some of the proteins went down. You can imagine it kind of makes this pattern. You can then upload that pattern to databases and say, what does that pattern look like compared to other conditions that have been measured? And two of them came, loads came back, but liver failure was one, and that was expected because your liver is your filtration organ. It receives blood directly from your intestine, goes straight to your liver to get processed, and that way, that's why if you eat serotonin, you don't get happy because your liver stops it, doesn't want any of that to happen, so it destroys the serotonin. So your liver processes everything that your intestines enjoy. So they're going to get the first load of plastics from that. So we got liver failure. The second biggest hit was dementia, which actually ties back to my research topic, and I did not expect this ever. And another signature we got was accelerated aging. And so we're now going to go out to the island now, and we're going to look at accelerated aging, and we're going to look at this dementia pattern, and we're going to see if it is happening in other bird species to show that it is a robust effect. It's not just related to those birds. We are going to measure this thing called telomeres. I imagine you might have covered this on the podcast. So telomeres are the protective caps on the ends of your chromosomes. And whenever your cells divide, a little protein machine, which is an enzyme, goes down and unzips your DNA, and it holds on to it, and it unzips it, and then it duplicates it. So you can imagine unzipping your DNA and then duplicating it, and that's how your DNA is duplicated. Well, this little machine has to hold on to the DNA. And so every time it duplicates, it actually can't duplicate the bit that it is holding on to, which is at the end of the DNA. So every time you replicate your DNA shrinks a little bit, and it gets smaller and smaller, and eventually, so we evolved a protective cap of essentially junk DNA on the ends of our DNA strands, so that when you delete a little bit, it's not a big deal because it was junk anyway. And this is sort of your biological clock. You can imagine that it shrinks every time your cells divide. Your cells are constantly replacing themselves. Eventually, you're going to start deleting important DNA. And this is one of your biological clocks that indicates aging. So you can roughly age something by measuring its telomeres, particularly in the earlier stages of life. It doesn't work so much when you're 50, 60, 70, but when you're younger, your biological age can be measured relatively well by measuring your telomere length. So we're going to measure the telomere lengths in these birds and see if plastics are accelerating the aging, because the proteins in the blood looked like an old person, but these birds are 90 days old. So these birds are young, but their proteins look old. A lot of the important growth factors that keep your brain functional and keep your body vital were way lower than what we expected. And that's what you see in accelerated aging. So we're going to look at the chromosome lengths. I've got a wonderful student over from Spain who's going to help me out with that this season. We've got nervous results about that. But certainly when you think life expectancies are declining and, you know, maybe we're accelerated aging. We know that chronic inflammation accelerates aging, and you know, you see a smoker and you'd estimate that they're 10 years older than they are, wouldn't you? You like just their whole body ages faster. And that's actually a good analogy we like to look at. Like sublethal plastics in all wildlife could be a little bit like all wildlife is now smoking. It's not killing them immediately. We're not seeing filter fish dropping dead immediately from a small amount of microplastics building up in their body, but it could be like smoking. It could be accelerated aging, early dementia, you know, build up of scar tissue, this kind of thing. It's only the animals that are really impacted that are suddenly dying, like our birds on the island. I don't have any good news for you. I wish I could talk about biodegradable plastics are great, but they're not. And we're recycling plastics really well, but we're not. So I've got very little good news on that front. We need to know this stuff though.
We need to be talking about this. So thank you for sharing that with us. I mean, I'll probably have to go and watch a comedy or something tonight, but you know, we need to have these discussions.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm just gonna go have a cry.
And because literally, like you're probably seen the news about they've got wax grubs that can eat plastic, or they've got bacteria that can eat plastic.
But this is all the false hope, and sorry to say, bullshit that we get fed with in so many other industries as well. It's the greenwashing. It's all misleading, and it's all to allow us to make us feel okay continuing down the same path that we are. That simple, right?
100%.
And not 100%. Bothering to hold companies accountable. Like, it's not just all on us as individuals. It's so complex to navigate through the world. We should be holding these companies to higher standards, you know?
And you know what the irony is with recycling is that often the bottles you can recycle, but they don't want the caps. But it's the caps that are ending up being ingested by the birds.
Causing damage.
Imagine if we could recycle the caps and those were actually higher value, maybe we'd have less bottle caps floating around. Just saying, as a sort of a hypothetical scenario. But it's like Emma says, this is what we need to know and understand, and it isn't a happy place.
No.
And without some ending off in a very doom and gloom way, this whole point of this podcast is to educate people. A lot of people like to go do some beach cleanups, and I incorporated my trail running camps and so on. We do a session where we go for a jog and pick up rubbish and plastic because we know that it ends up in the waterways, which ends up in our lakes and oceans and so on. But actually making that connection of how important it is to not just pick up rubbish, but actually to prevent that in the first place, and therefore start changing our habits in terms of how we go shopping.
One little thing, you said pick up rubbish, and you might feel like you it's a drop in the ocean. But once you start doing, once a week, you go pick up a bag of rubbish, your vision changes, and you can now see the plastic. You will be so surprised about how much rubbish is actually out there. You're just walking past it. And once you spend half an hour a week, which is what I try and do, picking up rubbish, you cannot change your eyes anymore, that you see the plastic everywhere, and it will drive, this one little thing will drive the passion and your votes with your dollars, which companies you work with and buy from. I think just that one little step, Ben, is such a good point. If you just pick up rubbish, you'll change your perspective. Yeah.
Once you see it, you can't unsee it. That's what happens in our plogging sessions, you know, little loops like, oh, we'll be done in 10 minutes. Meanwhile, two full bags each later on a little loop. It's scary.
Yeah.
And it's scary how much is out in nature as well on a trail. And once you start seeing something in the bush off the trail to one side, you start seeing a whole lot in nature. So
for sure.
Jack, look, fascinating, fascinating chat. So much. To digest, excuse the pun here. These are the kind of episodes that's worth listening to 2-3 times just to really take it all in. But we really sincerely appreciate not only your time to come onto the show, but the immense work that you do. Jen, we chat to regularly. She still passes on other wonderful guests to come onto the show. What a wonderful team that you all are that does so much good work. We just want to do our bit and give you or the opportunity to tell us the story, communicate the science that you guys are discovering. It's so important communicating that. We've had two wonderful guests previously that do it through filmmaking and storytelling and artwork, and you guys do all the important lab work and field work as well. So on. So thank you so much. We really appreciate your time, and maybe 3 years' time again, your kids will be four and seven, and we'll touch base again on the next bit of depressing research. Jack, again, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.